When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I'm talking with my favorite ICU doc. Hey, doc, how you doing?
Hey, Dennis. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you coming on because I have a pretty complicated topic is acute kidney injury. And if there was anybody that could walk me through it, I think it'd be you.
Awesome. Well, you know, the kidneys are probably one of the most complex organs that we deal with. And I'll lay claim to being a gifted amateur in taking care of them. But, you know, compared with my colleagues who are nephrology critical care, I definitely turn to them some advice. So hopefully I'll do a good job and not let down the side.
Right. Well, I think just starting off, you know, what exactly is an acute kidney injury?
Right. So, you know, the kidney is anatomically, the kidneys are, because there are two of them generally in most people, you know, an organ that filters out toxic solutes that the body produces, breakdown products of cell metabolism, like lactic acid, lactate, for instance. It retains, you know, beneficial solutes like bicarbonate, actually generates bicarbonate when it's needed. And it keeps the solutes in the body in equilibrium. So electrolytes like sodium and potassium, it can adjust to, you know, disruptions that, you know, we inflict on electrolyte metabolism and filters them out or retains them. And then it's also responsible for water balance, right? So in dehydration states, it can retain water, and in hyperhydration states, it can, you know, let water go. The kidneys are encapsulated in a pretty thick fibrous covering, even thicker and less flexible than the pleura of the lungs, since they really don't have to expand. That'll come up and be important a little later when we talk about, you know, hydration and fluid resuscitation of acute kidney injury and the limits of that. And so that's kind of, you know, and they sit in the retroperitoneum, sort of protected in, you know, the posterior lower thorax of the body, which again is highly protected, but a little bit of an inflexible environment, and that limits how much they can expand if subjected to a really high volume load. So acute kidney injury basically means that there's some disruption in the ability of the kidneys to function, and that disruption can either be something we call pre-renal, which is before the kidney, which is a drop in perfusion to the kidney. And basically, if it doesn't get enough blood supply, enough oxygen, the function of the nephrons, the tubules, and the microscopic apparatus of the kidney that do the work of solute management and water management just shut down. Then there's post-renal, where, you know, for instance, you have a big kidney stone and it blocks, you know, one of your ureters, and urine can't flow from the kidney down the ureter to the bladder. And urine can back up into the kidney and basically cause a pressure injury called hydronephrosis, where the kidney kind of swells up in its capsule. And eventually that capsule has limitations for how much it can expand. And the kidney basically gets an internal crush injury. The most common kind of acute kidney injury is something called intrinsic renal injury, where either toxins or inflammation or both damage, either temporarily impair or damage the microscopic apparatus inside the kidney. And that's probably the most common that we encounter. And that can be triggered by shock states, by lack of perfusion. So very commonly we see pre-renal injury, you know, drop in perfusion causes secondary concurrent intrinsic injury as, you know, hypoxic kidney cells then trigger an inflammatory response, and the inflammatory response impairs the ability of the kidney to do its work. Sorry, that was a really long answer. Is that good enough?
No, that was great. But it just got me thinking, you know, like you had mentioned, you know, hypotension is a potential cause for this, or the need for resuscitation is a cause for this. You know, but that's my number one priority, and I'm trying to use a urine output to guide my resuscitation. So kind of in that mix of I'm trying to resuscitate somebody and I don't have any urine output coming back, you know, at what point are you saying, like, okay, like, where is that stop point, I guess, in your decision-making process? Like, hey, we've been giving fluids. We're not getting anything back. You know, what tips you off that, hey, this guy probably has a kidney injury, and we need to start rethinking things?
Right. Let me answer the second half of that question first, and then we'll get in. Maybe I can answer the first half of that when we get into management. But actually, the failure of the kidneys to respond to volume resuscitation with urine output can be diagnostic. So I'll get to that second. So I think any shock state, right? So that means any significant illness or injury that causes a systemic response, you know, which we've talked about in our, you know, numerous podcasts about shock and resuscitation, puts the kidney at risk because it's one of the organs that is really, really dependent on good blood supply for function, and it's also one of the organs from which blood will be shunted toward, you know, the primary organs of the brainstem, the lungs, and the heart if there's not enough blood to go around. And so you always have to be suspicious. If a patient is, you know, very septic, very hypovolemic from dehydration, or, you know, like a diarrheal illness like cholera, for instance, or Ebola, or, you know, has had a big hemorrhage, then you have to suspect that the kidneys will be injured. And it's more likely than not that they will. So we talk about two types of acute kidney injury, or AKI, one being oliguric or aneuric, where oliguric means there's little urine output, suboptimal, you know, 5-10 cc's per hour. Aneuric meaning there's none whatsoever. You know, you dump fluid in and nothing comes out. And then there's non-oliguric, which basically means the kidneys are injured. There's some, you know, breakdown of their function. Some injury to, like I said, the macroscopic apparatus inside the kidney that will show up on chemical tests, but does not result in a fall in urine output. So the multiple, you know, couple ways that we have of diagnosing it in the field, in prolonged field care, are obviously more limited than what we do in the hospital. And the toughest is to diagnose non-oliguric acute kidney injury, or kidney injury where the urine output is preserved. And I think the number one thing is just suspicion. You know, if you have a shock state, you know, bad sepsis, bad trauma, assume that the kidneys are injured and take steps to protect them. And we'll talk about that in treatment. And if you have access to a urine dipstick and you see proteinuria on the urine dipstick, or you see a drop in creatinine excretion, which is on, you know, very few dipsticks, but some dipsticks measure creatinine, then you have an early warning sign that you may have a kidney injury. And then obviously, oliguria, you just measure urine output, which, you know, reinforces what we've been talking about since, you know, podcast one on prolonged field care is, you know, you got to measure the urine output. The kidneys are the canary in the coal mine of organ failure. And if that drops off, then you have an oliguric kidney injury.
So, you know, recognizing, let's say I do a dipstick and I'm starting to get proteinuria, you know, maybe I'm getting, some, you know, blood or anyway, I'm getting protein in the urine. Would I treat it a lot like a crush injury where I would start kind of delving down that path? Or would I just try and kind of overcome that, you know, with just like fluids, continue resuscitation?
Really good question. And it brings up a really important point. You know, so far we've kind of talked about reasons that the kidneys would be injured due to poor perfusion, right? Volume loss of what are either blood or plasma, water, liquid, basically. We do encounter, the kidneys are really, really sensitive to toxic injury. So basically toxic attack on those microscopic apparatus, the nephrons and tubules. Uh-huh. And you treat them differently, right? So a crush is a toxic injury to the kidney. And the toxin is myoglobin. So the same type of injury is the same type of toxin that's released in rhabdomyolysis, right? And that's treated differently from a hypovolemic kidney injury. And other, you know, forms of toxins that we might run into would be NSAID, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, like ibuprofen, aspirin overdose, either intentional, you know, you've got a guy that's hurting and he's just sucking down Motrin more than he should, especially if he or she is a little bit dehydrated. Some antibiotics can cause an acute kidney injury. That's very rare. And supplements can cause nutritional supplements, muscle building supplements can cause a toxic injury. All of those are treated a little bit differently from the hypovolemic injury that we're most likely to see in trauma.
Okay, so, you know, since there's so many, you know, different little paths that are very specific, obviously this is probably when you would call telemedicine and say, you know, I need help immediately to help me figure this out. I mean, what kind of framework can we give guys as far as how do I go through kind of and build my differential?
Sure. Well, obviously, crush is pretty easy. They're either crushed or they're not. Mm-hmm. Rhabdo is pretty easy. You should be able to get that through your history or the report of bystanders if the person is unresponsive. Other toxic ingestions, again, you can get from a history or report. And again, if you said, you know, other than crush, where we do have a CPG that can, you know, lead you down the initial treatment pathway. If you do suspect any type of a toxic ingestion, then I would be on the phone as early as possible. Even speed dialing, you know, poison control from wherever you are in the world, somebody will pick up and they're actually super helpful.
Yeah.
But you know, kind of focusing on hypovolemic kidney injury, which is, I think, you know, what we're most likely to see. You have a trauma patient or a septic patient. They've lost a lot of blood. You know, they've lost a lot of fluid. Then, you know, your management approach is number one, prevent further injury, right? So don't give them things that are toxic to the kidney, right? So don't give them any NSAIDs, right? No aspirin, no Motrin, no ibuprofen, nothing like that, no naproxen. If you need pain control, give them narcotics or give them Tylenol. Number two is, you may have to adjust the dosing of some medicines, specifically antibiotics. Almost all antibiotics have different dosing requirements for different levels of kidney function. And the trick is that they are dosed by something that's pretty objective that we measure at hospital labs called the glomerular filtration rate, or the GFR. And that's going to be tough for you to know in the field. And so, again, if you're having to give antibiotics, for, especially for sepsis, where antibiotics are really going to be important for your patient's survival, again, that's a reason to be on the phone early, either with a pharmacologist or an intensive care doc. So, you know, avoid further injury. And then the question is, you know, if you have a non-oliguric kidney injury, then, you know, your work is not really, is kind of done. You know, avoid further injury, ensure adequate volume replacement, but you don't need to really give volume challenge to spur urine output because you already have urine output. So the more interesting, you know, or pressing problem is you've got an oliguric or an anuric kidney injury, and, you know, they're not peeing enough or they're not peeing at all. And that's where we get into, you know, fluid challenges and fluid administration. And the idea is to give some, either, you know, blood products if it's trauma, or crystalloid, or even oral rehydration, if it's medical sepsis or dehydration, and see if the urine output picks up. And the question is, you know, how much do I give and how much is too much? And that's, you know, if I could answer that question, I could probably retire from critical care medicine.
Right.
Because it's like the essential question in critical care medicine. And so I would say give some and observe, and then give some more and observe. And if you get to, you know, 20 cc's per kilogram or at sort of the low end, or, you know, 30 cc's per kilogram at the high end, which is kind of what sepsis protocols recommend, and they're not responding, then I would stop and say they probably have an intrinsic injury that's just not going to be volume responsive. And all that I'm going to do with more volume is push fluid into a kidney that's probably third spacing and cause compression from the inside.
Mm-hmm. Well, that fluid, you mentioned like 20, 30 cc's. Would you do it kind of the same way with sepsis, and that if you hit that mark within 3 hours, that's it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would probably back off. I mean, as we talked in our recent sepsis podcast, most of us are fans now of giving, you know, less fluid and moving to pressors earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that 30 cc's per kilogram of 30 cc's per kilogram of ideal, it's adjusted body weight, is unique in all shock states. You know, for hypovolemic and for hypovolemic shock, you know, the limit is 20 per kilogram, so mm-hmm. It's a little bit less. So I would be judicious because, you know, if they're not responding, let's say, you know, easy rule of thumb, if they're not responding to 2 liters, they're probably not going to respond.
Right.
So.
Okay. Now, you know, talking with other docs, you know, we talk about resuscitation and at some point we talk about the kidneys at some point.
Yep.
And I've heard this, you know, many times where they'll say, well, the dumbest kidney is smarter than the best nephrologist. So, you know, essentially don't worry about the kidneys. You know, you just do your part and it'll do his, right? How long, I guess, should I expect until this, you know, this kidney is going to just wake up? You know what I mean?
Right.
That's definitely something is kind of confusing.
Yeah, it is. And it's confusing to, you know, those of us in medicine as well. I think what that thing is getting at is that the kidney is, even though an easily injured organ, it's pretty resilient. It's kind of like the liver. It's remarkably resilient. The one caveat to, you know, hey, the kidneys could recover, even if I don't worry about them that much, is toxic injury. You know, if you have a bad crush injury, bad rhabdo, an NSAID overdose, then you better be jumping on getting that person to stabilized with fluid and you know, the algorithms for crush injury or rhabdo, and on their way to dialysis as soon as you can. Mm-hmm. Because toxins can cause an irreversible injury. Inflammation or hypoxia, which we see in trauma and sepsis, is much less likely to cause a permanent injury quickly. In young, healthy kidneys, you know, people without chronic kidney disease, most acute kidney injuries, even those that require dialysis, renal replacement therapy, we call it dialysis, you know, whether intermittent or around the clock, ICU dialysis, which we call CRRT, continuous renal replacement therapy, most kidneys recover and come off dialysis, you know, sometimes, usually within days. Sometimes I've seen it take as long as weeks in my personal experience, 2 to 3 weeks. But most young, healthy kidneys will recover from a hypoxic hypovolemic insult.
Okay. Well, that's definitely comforting.
It is.
But, you know, you mentioned, you know, toxic injury. And like you said, you know, crush is definitely part of that. So if you don't mind going through some of the crush injury protocol, and let's talk about how exactly each kind of component is meant to work. So, I mean, guys understand, hey, I give them fluids, I want to start flushing out the kidneys. I think guys understand that. But yep. The things like bicarbonate, albuterol, the insulin and D50, I really don't think... They understand, like, that's part of the protocol, but they don't really understand what it's doing.
Sure. Well, the bicarbonate is meant to be protective to the inner workings of the kidney. You want to start an argument in a room full of nephrologists, ask them if you need bicarbonate to stabilize the kidney or not. But it's also something that we carry. Uh-huh. It's also something that's super useful for other acute critical conditions that we encounter in prolonged field care, such as, you know, acidosis causing coagulopathic bleeding in trauma, or, as a surrogate for hypertonic saline in traumatic brain injury with swelling. So it's shelf stable, it's packable. So, you know, bicarb, we love us some bicarb. And in kidney injury, there is some evidence that giving bicarbonate won't necessarily improve outcomes or survival outcomes, but may improve kidney outcomes, basically, may decrease the number of people who require dialysis for an acute kidney injury. So I guess, you know, Doug's personal prolonged field care take on it is you have it. It may do some help, and it probably won't do any harm given cautiously. The known side effects of given bicarbonate are it will cause a transient non-anion gap metabolic acidosis as it breaks down into water and carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide is an acid. So obviously, if you've got a bleeding patient, you don't want them to become more acidotic. But CO2 is relatively quickly mobilized by respiration, so you can get rid of it. It's not as bad as a chloride acidosis, for instance, from over-resuscitation with normal saline. It is sodium bicarbonate, and it is concentrated, so you can make somebody hypernatremic, which is a benefit, but you just don't want to give so much that it causes, rebound brain swelling. The paper that I referenced for our chat today talked about, giving a half an amp of bicarb in 250 cc's of fluid over 30 minutes up to a liter a day. So that was basically 2 amps of sodium bicarbonate in a day. And I can tell you, you're not going to see any bad side effects from that.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty slow.
Right. Routinely in the ICU, if we've got somebody who's hemorrhaging and their pH is, 6.9, 7.0, 7.1, and we're trying to get on top of the acidosis, we'll give 3 amps of sodium bicarb right away, and then we'll put 6 amps in a liter of fluid and run it, at a slow infusion. So that's not bad. two amps in the day isn't bad at all.
If you don't mind me jumping in, what exactly is the bicarb doing? I mean, obviously we know that we're creating CO2 and water, you know, the whole mm-hmm. respiration cycle, but what is it doing for the kidney?
It's a buffer, basically. It's a buffer against acidic damage in the kidney, I think would be the best way to describe it. And it may have some anti-inflammatory effects as well that we don't know about.
Okay.
So.
All right. I'll buy that.
The albuterol, the insulin, and the glucose are not treatment for acute kidney injury per se, but are treatment for one of the side effects of acute kidney injury, which is namely an inability to filter out potassium. And potassium is in high levels is a very dangerous electrolyte to the electrical conducting system of the heart. It can cause, you know, fatal arrhythmias. And so generally in hypoxic hypovolemic kidney injury, your potassium levels aren't rising that much or that quickly. And, hopefully you'll have time, you know, and by not that quickly, I mean like 1 to 2 days. We routinely have people in the intensive care unit with hypovolemic kidney injury from, you know, cardiogenic shock or sepsis, and, you know, their urine output isn't great for a couple days, and we're thinking about putting them on renal replacement therapy, dialysis, and their potassium is, you know, 4, 4.5, 4.8, 5.3, all of which are, you know, over 5 is obviously something to be concerned about, but it's probably not going to flip you into torsades. Mm-hmm. Where you really worry about potassium is in crush, because then you not only have a potassium burden that comes from kidney dysfunction, but much, much, much more significantly comes from the breakdown of muscle cells containing potassium. And, you know, orders of magnitude more potassium are inside cells than are circulated around the bloodstream. So let's say normal potassium is, you know, 4. In the bloodstream, you know, more normal potassium inside a cell might be 40 or 100. And so you damage enough cells and they release their intracellular potassium, and that'll spike your serum potassium up, you know, very dramatically to a point where you just manage it as a reflex, even without, you know, knowing to diagnose it in crush and rhabdo. Mm-hmm. So in crush and rhabdo, absolutely reach for your insulin, your D50, your albuterol, nebulizers, MDIs, as effective, maybe, but, you know, insulin D50, Lasix if you have it, because Lasix lowers potassium and it causes the kidney to excrete more potassium, which is a side effect we deal with when we're using it in heart failure. But we have to replace potassium.
Right.
And then get them to heck to dialysis as soon if you can. Hypovolemia, you know, shock, septic shock, hemorrhagic shock. I think you need to at some point be looking if you're having kidney failure and they're not seeing, at some point you need to be able to check up serum potassium. But it's not nearly the urgency that you have in crush.
Okay. So I would imagine that, you know, when you're talking about like monitors as part of resuscitation, mm-hmm. if you have an ongoing resuscitation, like this is taking a long time, probably the need to get some kind of a 3-lead of some kind probably keeps going up, right? It's because that potassium can be starting to build up, things like that.
Yeah. Again, it's much more urgent when you've got muscle breakdown.
Right.
You know, muscle breakdown, rhabdo, crush, absolutely. You know, maybe even burn as well. You want to be on a 3-lead sooner rather than later.
Right.
Trauma, it would be good, but you want a 3-lead for trauma for other reasons too.
Right. The albuterol, how do you administer that? I mean, like the once or twice doing it in training, I just grabbed like three or four of the little containers it comes in. I squeezed it into a nebulizer and sent it. But that were at that time, we were running the line on that EKG of between living and going into a cardiac arrest. So,
right.
I don't know if that's the best way to do it.
Yeah. I think you want to put like, you know, three or four in a nebulizer and you want to run it over, you know, 20 minutes if you can.
Okay.
I think you want to run it over 20 minutes if you can.
Okay.
And what it does is it drives potassium back into the cells. That's the mechanism of action for both insulin and albuterol, is it drives potassium back inside of cells, you know, and out of the bloodstream. So lower, and what your heart is affected by is potassium in the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. The D50 isn't a treatment for the hyperkalemia. The D50 is to keep you from going hypoglycemic when you give insulin to a non-diabetic. You know, right. If I gave you, you know, what is it, 10 units of insulin, you know, your blood sugar would probably go to 20 and you'd fall out. So the idea is, you know, I'm going to give you insulin to stabilize your potassium, but I'm going to give you the D50 to counteract the effects of the insulin.
Right. How much D50 would you normally do that?
An amp.
1 amp. Now with this Lasix, talking about Lasix, you know, that's really kind of counterintuitive from what we've been doing, right? Making a kidney pee, or making the body create pee when, you know, it wasn't doing that before, you know, driving right. the urine output higher than normal. How much of an increase should I expect? Because whenever somebody brings it up, like, oh yeah, we'll just throw some Lasix on them. You know, I ask them, my first question is, well, how much resources do you have to replace the urine that is going to be coming out?
Right. Yeah, it is counterintuitive that, you know, in a resuscitation standpoint, you may be giving something that promotes hypovolemia. So it's something that, again, I probably wouldn't do unless I'm under telemedicine guidance. Mm-hmm. You know, a typical starting dose is 40 milligrams IV. And, you know, under telemedicine guidance, that can be doubled and even tripled or more. But again, I wouldn't, you know, you really need to be under the care of an expert at that point.
Yeah.
And your response could be anything from, you know, brisk, all of a sudden, you know, kidneys respond to the Lasix and start peeing when before they weren't. That happened to me, you know, last night. I had a gentleman who, you know, was volume overloaded from heart failure and going into respiratory distress, and we were upping his oxygen delivery, and got a chest x-ray, and it looked like he had, you know, a lot of pulmonary edema, and I gave him, you know, 80 of Lasix and he didn't respond, and then I gave him another 40 and he didn't respond, and then we put him on a Lasix drip and all of a sudden he responded. So, you know, it's tough to tell. You know, you give a dose, it could either respond, in which case it's like, wahoo, you know, great stuff, or it could not. And then your question is, well, do I give more or not? And that's going to be limited, number one, by your resources. And number two, really, doses more north of 40 to 40 milligrams should be guided by an expert.
Yeah.
And they may not respond, right? Sometimes you give, and so what we would do as intensivists is, you know, give a bunch, maybe try something else like a drip. And if they're not responding, then, you know, then they're just not responding and they need to be on dialysis for volume and solute management. And if they are responding and they're putting out a lot of urine and they're in a resuscitation state, then you basically need to be replacing that one for one.
Right.
Or more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honestly, in prolonged field care, the only role for Lasix in acute kidney injury is for crush and rhabdo. Mm-hmm. Because it's going to do two things. It's going to augment the hydraulic flow of fluid through the tubules, flushing out that sticky myoglobin, and it's going to lower the potassium breakdown product of all that cell injury.
Right.
Other than that, if you're thinking about LASIK for acute kidney injury and you don't have CRUSH and or you don't have rhabdo, then either, you know, have another thought or phone a friend.
Right. Because like, what was it 90% or the majority of potassium leaves the body through the urine, correct?
Right.
So, because I just got to thinking, like, why? I do not remember LASIX being part of the CRUSH protocol, but I do remember K-Exalate being part of it. Mm-hmm. And so small of a percentage of potassium actually goes through the feces or the GI tract. It just got me thinking, like, why did they not just use LASIX instead?
Yeah, I think it was a resource thing. It's, you know, it's just not on many people's pharmacopoeia. Thanks, that was the word I was looking for. But in civilian medicine, I can tell you for sure, you know, it's in the mix for rhabdo and CRUSH.
Okay. All right, sweet. Let me think. I guess with acute kidney injury, we're definitely, we've beaten up, you know, fluid status, electrolyte imbalance to whatever extent we can do it. You know, essentially running a CRUSH protocol, you know.
Right.
Is there any other main considerations we really need to watch out for?
I can't think of any. We've been pretty exhaustive in our discussion.
Right.
You know, short of getting to labs, at some point, if you get, you know, if you're really worried about, an aneuric, you know, no urine output or very, very low urine output, kidney injury, getting to labs at some point just to reassure yourself that your electrolytes are not reaching toxic levels. And then beyond getting them, to someplace where they can be under the care of someone who can provide dialysis if that's needed.
Right. Yep. Get them off your hands as quickly as possible. At least from my point of view, this patient is definitely outside of my comfort zone for certain.
Right. But I would reassure, you know, the medic, the pulmonary field care practitioners, you know, who do have to deal with, you know, hypovolemic acute kidney injury, that that they do have time. I think in general, you know, there's always going to be the outlier, somebody who spikes their potassium for whatever reason, that's their physiology. But in general, you have time, and by time, I mean days, you know, at least a day, potentially longer, of no urine output. Before you're really in the woods. And so, you know, you have much, much less time for other things, right? Acidosis, you know, respiratory failure without ventilator support, you know, hypovolemic shock that you can't resuscitate because you can't stop the bleeding. You have much less time for all of those than you do for an aneuric or oliguric kidney injury due to hypovolemia. Toxic, not so much. NSAID overdose, CRUSH, rhabdo, not so much. But for hypovolemic acute kidney injury, you've got some time.
Okay. Well, standing.
And your prognosis for recovery. Sorry to cut you off. And your prognosis for recovery is good. There you go.
Hey, thank you very much, Doug. I really appreciate walking me through this.
Thanks, Dennis. It was a good chat, and I had fun studying up for it and thinking about it, and always a pleasure to be on the pod.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Every boy is waiting there for you.